Well, good morning and welcome back to the program. It's Evan Bray on this Wednesday morning, Ukrainian Christmas. So Merry Christmas to our Ukrainian friends that are celebrating. We know there's a lot of people with Ukrainian ancestry in our province. And so for all of you, Merry Christmas today on this Wednesday. Brian Zinchuk, are you? You're not Ukrainian, are you?
My late Baba used to put on quite the feast.
Did she? Did you do the 12 meatless dishes?
She actually would. So one of my favorites, which we'd only have once a year, is my grandfather would go out into the back of the yard and pick what we call pipinke, which is a mushroom.
Right.
They're, I don't know what they're called, but they look long and kind of wrinkled. And they would save that for Christmas dinner. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it was a big to-do.
Mm-hmm. Well, my daughter-in-law is Ukrainian. Her mom and dad put on a big feast they did last night for Ukrainian New Year's or Christmas Eve. We weren't able to go to it, but, you know, I learned words like studenets and baraboya and, you know, all these good.
Yeah, stuff I don't even remember. So, all right.
Brian Zinchuk from pipelineonline.ca here for his regular visit. Listen, we talk about your late Baba. I have to give you credit for that cheesecake you brought us just before Christmas.
It's really not that easy. And here's a hint, guys, if you can learn how to make a cheesecake, it really impresses the women. So,
well, Brian, I thought of all the things that I would expect Brian Zinchuk to be able to do, bake a cheesecake was not one of them. But Frank can attest to it. We tried it. It was incredible. We put it in the kitchen here after Frank and I had a piece of it and said, hey, Brian Zinchuk brought this in. It was gone in 45 minutes. People were loving it.
So let's get to the oil prices here.
Are you pushing me on the agenda,
Brian? Yeah, let's get going.
Oil
here.
Prices, where are we at?
All right. So as of this morning, West Texas Intermediate is $56.74. Western Canadian Select is $43.05. And Brent, which is the global price, is $60.69. Now, why is all this is significant is that Trump just knocked over the Venezuelan regime, grabbed them, flew them back to New York, and oil prices barely even had a hiccup.
They did move a bit, though.
Yeah.
Right? There was a drop.
The difference is like intraday trading. Like, it's really not a big deal.
Okay.
You know, it used to be you'd not have a regime change or a war or something like that in a major oil producer, and things would move $5, $10. Now this nothing.
So why do you think that is, Brian?
I really don't know. I mean, they Trump bombed Iran, nothing. Go nabs Maduro, nothing. You know, so what does it take? A geopolitical risk, which used to be a major part of oil pricing, no longer exists, especially with probably the most unstable president they've had in the U.S. in decades.
I was reading on your website the other day, which is the only place I go for energy news, by the way, pipelineonline.ca. But you were talking about in the budget for this year for the province, the province, I think, budgeted $71 a barrel.
That's right. And I sent you a graph here. If you take a look at it, there is a big slope going down like this. And this is exactly, I've said this every time since Trump got elected, price keeps going down. And that's where we're at. It is consistently going down. And that's a big problem because when the province set its forecast, as I heard you talk to the premier this morning, mm-hmm. $71, well, we're $71 for just a few days.
Right.
And everything else has been below that, which means when it comes to provincial budget time, that will be a shortage of many $100 million. Like, we're probably going to be short 200, 300, maybe 400 million. So where does that come from? Well, that comes from everything else. That is what pays for my wife's emergency room at the Estevan St. Joseph's Hospital. That's what pays for the roads and for prisons and schools and everything else. And when that revenue falls, there will be impact. So do not be shocked.
You know, it's interesting, Brian, because when you and I talk about this, and we do talk about it almost every month you're here, oil prices, inevitably, and I don't see one yet on the text line, but inevitably there are texters saying, yeah, but I like cheaper gas, so I'm not disappointed that oil prices have gone down.
Well, when they close their local hospital, good luck with that.
Yeah, I mean, this is a big revenue source.
It's a very real thing. I mean, you know, my wife comes home and she's frustrated with the fact that
your wife works at the hospital.
She is a senior nurse, mm-hmm. And she's frustrated with the fact that other hospitals throughout the region, they're short on doctors, and they end up diverting everything to Estevan because they're on bypass. Well, why are we short on doctors? Well, money is a big thing of that. Where does that money come from? It doesn't fall from the sky. It's you know,
taxpayers.
It's either got to come from royalties or from taxes. So if you're not going to, yeah, you might get cheaper gas, but guess what? Don't be surprised if they have to do a PST adjustment.
Right.
You know, these are the realities they have.
Mm-hmm. Brian Zinchuk is my guest. PipelineOnline.ca. What about rigs? We usually kind of do oil prices and rig counts. They're still low.
Yeah, they are. So as of Monday, the total was 31 across the province. This is not a good number, and I cannot see it improving. We might pick up one or two this week, but I wouldn't see another 10, I don't expect. In northwest Saskatchewan, we had 8 rigs working. In west central, we had 7 rigs plus one working at Elstow, east of Saskatoon, for potash. So, I mean, it's a working rig, but it's not for oil. One working in southwest Saskatchewan, and then 14 in southeast Saskatchewan. But one of those, there was obviously an error in the entry on the map. Actually, Brian Crossman pointed out when I talked to him about it, and it was showing that it's working between Indian Head and Fort Capel, but in reality, they messed up on the west of the third. It should be west. They put west of the second instead of west of the third in the mapping. So he shifted over 100 and some miles to the west, and it's probably near Swift Current.
Okay.
So let's put this in historical context. Even during the downturn and the bad times, this time of year is January, February is the busiest drilling season of the year. That's the highest numbers you're going to get. And usually we'd have 39, 43, 49 rigs. We have 31 rigs. Mm-hmm. The rig count is depressed. Even if it picks up to 34, that is still depressed. During the boom years, for perspective, we were doing 110.
And it's all, well, predominantly predicated on prices, right?
Very much
so. If the price was better, you'd see more.
Well, rigs. You would see more, but, and I don't want to beat the dead horse about the multilateral things, but that also has a very large impact
right,
as well.
Right. Brian Zinchuk is my guest, pipelineonline.ca. And by the way, whenever we have Brian in, I welcome you to shoot us a text or let us know if you've got a question. 1-877-332-8255. I see some questions are coming in. We're going to get to those here in the next little bit. Brian is with us right up until 11 o'clock this morning, so lots of time to get your questions in. Let's broach the topic of Venezuela. We probably are going to talk about this for a little bit, but you are in touch with many people in the oil industry. I just had a caller on Open Lines that said, let's not forget, we haven't heard a lot from the big oil companies saying, woohoo, we're going into Venezuela, we're going to be investing in there. Do you see this as an attractive place for U.S. investment?
Well, Trump is having a meeting here, I think, on Thursday or Friday with several of the larger players. Chevron is the last oil company from the U.S. that's been active in there right now. The other ones have been. I'll get into more detail about that stuff in the next segment. But the reality is, when they came in and they grabbed Maduro, they killed 24 people, and plus another 24 Venezuelans, plus another 32 Cubans.
Yeah,
and I only saw that mentioned like once or twice in all this coverage. You know, it's like no one even bothered to mention it. Well, the way you start an insurgency is you kill someone's son, and then the dad takes it kind of personal. Or you kill someone's dad, and the son takes it personal. And then they pick up a gun, and they shoot the first American that comes by. Welcome to Iraq, mm-hmm. okay? And, you know, so if you start sending in workers from the U.S., and even a year or two from now, they don't forget that dad got killed by an American bomb. Mm-hmm. This is how an insurgency starts. This is why then all of a sudden you have to have American forces on the ground, and someone is going to put a bullet through someone's head, and then it gets worse and worse and worse. And then you have Iraq, and then you have a forever war that lasts for 15, 20 years.
There's lots of speculation about the length that this is going to extrapolate out.
And everyone's like, oh, well, why are my boys coming home in body bags? This is how it starts. So let's go into that in the next segment.
that's where you're going to leave it, and we're going to go into the break. Okay, we are going to talk more about the impact that a potential revived Venezuelan oil industry will have on Canada. I also want to talk about this notion of David Eby throwing out, we need more refineries in Canada. Of course, he's saying it to say, instead of pipelines, it's not an either-or discussion. So this and more, including your questions, with Brian Zinchuk from PipelineOnline.ca when we come back here on 650 CKOM and 980 CJME.
Now,
Welcome back to the program, Evan Bray, and this is our monthly check-in with Brian Zinchuk, who is the editor and owner of PipelineOnline.ca. We had Premier Scott Moe on this morning. Of course, we wanted to get his thoughts on what are the implications for the Saskatchewan oil industry. I think you said you caught part of that discussion.
Yeah, he basically used all my good lines, so I'll try not to repeat.
Did he get them from you?
Well, you know, the remarkable thing is that actually I was quite surprised. So I wrote a column on Saturday when this happened. I held it till Monday, and by the time I had already published it, so many people out in the industry, as well as even in political space and media space, were all saying the same thing. Mm-hmm. And that is that apparently there's a lot more knowledge than I thought people would have. The reality is, for the last 15 years, Canada has been eating Venezuela's lunch, because Venezuela has been driving its economy and its oil industry into the ground, right, under its socialist leadership of first Chavez and then Maduro. I remember going to the Lloydminster Oil Show in 2008, talking to people in Lloydminster who worked in Venezuela. Their company had an office in Venezuela.
Okay.
And after a couple years after, I said, no, we're not ever going back there. We're done. Mm. And why was that? Because Lloydminster oil production was basically indistinguishable from Venezuelan oil production. So anything that they could do in Lloydminster to produce heavy oil. And heavy oil is, last I checked, is almost exactly half of Saskatchewan production right now. That is what they produce. Now, if our oil sands and our heavy oil is hard to produce, theirs is even harder. And they also have the...
Some of it's offshore.
This stuff is all onshore.
Is it?
Yeah, it's onshore. It's inland from the coast, a place called the Orinoco Belt. And it is by far the largest oil reserve known on the planet. Okay, so it blows away Saudi Arabia and Canada and Iran. Some people say that Iran is more than Canada, but do you trust anything coming out of Iran? So I don't know.
Yeah.
But the reality is that as our production has grown, and we've grown a few million barrels over the last couple of decades in production, most of which goes to the United States. That's why we built the Keystone Pipeline 12 or so years ago. That's why we built the Alberta Clipper Pipeline for heavy oil. Mm-hmm. Most of that goes to the Midwest, but some of that goes down to the Gulf Coast. And plus, that's why my mom, who lives on the CPR main line in Yorkton, has trains rolling right past her place, you know, every day hauling oil. Well, all that stuff is going into the American market. And back in, you know, when oil first became a thing in the early 1900s, the United States was by far the largest producer on the planet. And they went for the easy stuff. It was the light, sweet crude. Mm-hmm. Well, as that stuff kind of got depleted, and oil production peaked in 1971, they had to go for the stuff that wasn't so sexy. That was the heavy oil. That was the sour stuff.
Talk about the difference, Brian. Let's just pause for a second, because there's been a lot of talk in the news recently about heavy oil and how the Venezuelan oil is very similar to what we produce in Saskatchewan and Alberta. I know we've talked about it before.
Yeah, so
explain the difference.
There's basically three grades. No one talks much about medium grade. We produce some of that from the Shaunavon area. But most of it is either light oil or heavy oil. And light means that it's a high API. It means that it's
API not, meaning
it's not very viscous.
Okay,
like the stuff you get out of Wilson, North Dakota, you can basically almost put it into your crankcase for your F-150.
It doesn't need a lot of refining.
In fact, they built a refinery out near Kerrobert that uses light oil from the Viking area near Kindersley. That, you know, I've driven past it. There's really not much to it. It's very simple. Okay, and light oil is not hard to refine to make it into diesel, and even it doesn't take too much to make it into gasoline. But when it comes to heavy oil, the hydrocarbon chains are much longer, which means you have to crack them, and you have to do that through thermal processes. So you have to have something called a coker. That's why we built the Regina and the Lloydminster upgraders, because it's a lot more difficult to work with. It becomes much, much more complex. I know you wanted to talk about David Eby talking about a refinery on the West Coast. Well, okay, so we're talking here in the terms of 1 million barrels, 2 million barrels. That's potentially what's at play, because as the Premier noted, Venezuela used to produce 3 million plus barrels per day a few decades ago. Now, they were down to 300,000 5 years ago, and they're back to 1 million now. They could, if... the Americans successfully get this done without a war starting, which is very likely.
Yeah.
They could, you know, restore possibly 1 million, maybe eventually 2 million barrels, which every barrel of that heavy oil displaces Canadian oil. Because what happened was, as I was going here into the 70s, they were looking around, okay, we're running out of, you know, easy oil in the United States. Huber did his peak oil thing, or maybe it was King, it was, sorry. And anyhow, oh, look, not very far away, 5-day sail is Venezuela, and they have all this stuff. Well, let's do that. So Citgo and a bunch of other companies did a bunch of refinery upgrades along the Gulf Coast so that you can bring a tanker from Venezuela, 5-day sail, over there, and then you can process this heavy oil. And all they built all these refineries decades ago to handle heavy oil. And people don't build a lot of refineries these days. Greenfield refineries in North America basically never happen. It's much easier to expand or modify an existing refinery than to start a greenfield one. Just doesn't happen.
Right. Is it because of cost?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So they set up all the refinery space to handle Venezuelan oil. Venezuela production dropped. At the same time, Canadian oil went up. So it's almost an inverse relationship. They went down, we went up. We ate their lunch. We took their spot in those refinery spaces and shipped our oil down to the coast. And that's how we've been producing stuff for the last 10, 15 years. Well, if they come back, uh-oh, now what? And especially when you have a president who just, you know, used a lot of political capital to knock over a country, his preference is going to be that over this. And by flooding the market with...
Because our pipelines are flowing to those very same refineries.
Some of them are. Yeah. The Keystone is. Keystone XL was supposed to as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, most of our product goes to the Midwest, but some of it goes to the South. And the thing is that all of it is price sensitive. And if there is a flood of heavy oil on the market from Venezuela, we could see a drop in our prices, our realized prices for Western Canadian Select, the WCS number I start the show with. We had differentials $20, $30, $40 briefly a few years ago.
Per barrel.
So we're basically giving oil away. And that is the biggest threat to Saskatchewan in this, is that even if we can still sell our oil, but the differential rises to $30, $40, we're literally giving it away and our royalties just go.
But if we have access through a new pipeline to other markets, that potentially saves us there, does it not?
Yes, and that is the big thing. That's what my column was, and that's what everyone's talking about now, is that the bell went off. You know, we need to get to other markets. We need to get to the West Coast.
And if there wasn't an urgency before, there certainly is.
Absolutely. You got it. Okay.
I've got a couple of refinery questions that have come in on the text line. After the break, maybe we'll start with those. One of them asking, how much of Canadian product that we use is refined Canadian oil? So people wanting to know, how much are we mining in Canada and supplying to us here in Canada? And do we have the capacity through our refineries to supply all of Canada with oil and gas? That's where we'll start with Brian when we come back here on 980 CJME and 650 CKOM. Welcome back to the show. Evan Bray, joined by Brian Zinchuk, who is the owner and editor of pipelineonline.ca. Brian stops in for a chat with us monthly, usually the first Wednesday of every month at 10 o'clock is where we chat all things energy. So we have been talking a little bit about refineries. This has come up because David Eby, who is the premier of BC, who has been dead set against any pipeline going through his province to the West Coast, throws out yesterday, well, maybe we should look at a refinery instead of a pipeline. Maybe that's more important. Now, we have got a number of texts that have come in this morning, Brian. One, Clinton Lumsden, for example, asking, what is the capacity at our refineries to supply all of Canada with the oil and gas we need?
So as far as I'm aware, Canada is self-sufficient in refining capacity. In fact, we've kind of shut some refineries down, like the one in Newfoundland was converted to bio-refining or something like that. The biggest one in Canada is one at St. John. That's the Irving Refinery. They bring in oil from overseas, Saudi Arabia, but I did a column a few years ago about they bring in oil from Azerbaijan, mm-hmm. which is in the center of Asia, and they somehow get it over there by tanker, and that's a long discussion on that. So, I mean, that we're not short on refining capacity, but in eastern Canada, we import oil to refine. In western Canada, we're self-sufficient. My father-in-law hauls refined products for Federated Co-op. So he's all over Saskatchewan, Eastern Alberta, and Manitoba on any given day. So we refine our own product here for fuel, and we export the surplus. This is kind of same thing for wheat. You know, we don't make a lot of pasta here. We export our surplus. Mm-hmm. No one does a greenfield refinery. And greenfield, if people don't know, it means that you start in an area that was, you know, once a cropland or whatever, and you build something that was never there before. That just doesn't happen with refineries. It hasn't happened in Canada, at least in my lifetime that I'm aware. What you do is you take an existing refinery and you refurbish it, you expand it. Regina has gone through 5 expansions over its 90-year history. Mm-hmm. The last one was Section 5, which was in 2012, 2014. And that expansion, which added 25,000 barrels or so of capacity, bringing it to 130,000 barrel capacity, was $2.4 billion 12 years ago.
Yeah. So it's big bucks.
So if we're talking, if you want to build a refinery that would have, you know, the size of Regina right now, and you're starting from scratch, easily $10 billion to give you 130,000 barrel capacity, easily. Mm-hmm. And when we're talking this Venezuela thing and pipelines, we're not talking 130,000 barrels. We're talking 10 times that, 1.3 million barrels, 1 million barrels. So, you know, are we going to build a 100 million barrel, $100 million refinery to handle 1 million barrels per day? And we don't have the market to use that product, because if we did, we'd already have that refining capacity. You know, we sell our surplus because we don't need it ourselves. You know, so yeah, sure, we could build 1 million barrel per day, but then instead of shipping, you know, one product, a crude oil, then we're shipping diesel, gasoline, jet fuel. I mean, we could use some expanded capacity, especially in the jet fuel side on the West Coast. Absolutely, because we're importing that right now. But we have a refinery sitting at Burnaby, a small one, and it was recently sold to an American company, too. I think it was Sunoco. You know, it was run by Canadian companies, Parkland and others over the years. And now it's owned by an American company. Well, how did that happen?
I want to go back to the talk about Venezuelan oil and the size of the resource that they possess, the depth of their oil wells and their capacity, because there's a few people on the text line that are saying, you know, listening to you talk about this, and I've talked about it as well, but saying, don't forget those numbers are inflated because those are Maduro's numbers and none of that has been fact-checked.
Well, those numbers were in place long before Maduro took over, even before Chavez. And the reality is that the United States Geological Survey, which most people would say would probably be the most credible assessor for this sort of thing on the planet, those are the numbers that they use. So, I mean, people can dismiss it or whatever. I mean, I just dismiss the Iranian thing, and maybe I'm incorrect on that. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that those numbers are pretty much well accepted around the planet.
There's a lot of text coming in. I see one here from Ken in Regina wanting to talk a bit about royalties. Ken says, for Brian Zinchuk, I'm not clear on what royalties the province of Saskatchewan gets on a barrel of oil. What's the difference, brackets payment, when oil is $75 U.S. versus $50 U.S. to Saskatchewan's general revenue?
Okay, so it's a very complicated thing, and I write about this, and I don't even fully understand it, to be quite honest. It depends on if a well is drilled under a certain program, such as almost all wells in Saskatchewan qualify for the horizontal drilling program, which means they get a little bit of a reduction in royalty. The fact that we still have a royalty reduction for that, even though all wells are horizontal, doesn't make a lot of sense, okay. But it's next to impossible to remove these things when they bring them in. When I did the big piece about the multilateral program, I asked for what would be a kind of a standard royalty. And I said, and so the number came back about 17.5%. So that would mean that if he sold $100 barrel at mm-hmm. the wellhead, then, you know, the province would get $17. If you sell a $50 barrel, then you get, you know, $8.50, $8.75. So that's how that comes out. But if you have another program, such as the multilateral program, you reduce the royalty to 2.5%. Well, now on a $50 barrel, you're getting $1.25. You know, that's what the reality is for the royalties. So the schemes, and it, you know, there's enhanced oil recovery things. It's very complex, but I will say this, you know, and some people might criticize me for saying this, but I had a conversation with my best friend who is my webmaster, who leans very far to the left. And this is a few months ago, and he was criticizing how You know, he said the Saskatchewan government gives, gives away our resources for next to nothing. I had a hard time arguing with him because our potash royalty, the base royalty is 3%. We just established a lithium royalty at 3%. The multilateral program came in at 2.5%. You know, and you look at that and you add up, you know, remember I said about my wife's hospital, you don't pay for a lot of doctors, you know, build a lot of hospitals at 2.5%. And I've kind of come to the realization, you know, does that mean everything in Saskatchewan is only worth 3%, 2.5%? That's the only return. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and people will criticize me for saying this, but the reality is whenever you bring in a royalty review, such as Stelmec did in 2009, industry loses its mind. Mm-hmm. And we, as Saskatchewan, gained a lot of industrial activity because everyone was afraid of a royalty adjustment in Alberta. And every month I wrote a story about what I called refugees from Stelmec. So the difficulty of royalties is that once you set them, they're next to impossible to change without, you know, people saying, oh, my
God. There's not a lot of political will to change.
No,
I mean, when it comes down.
You know, Bill Boyd did the same speech his entire time as energy minister, said, we're not touching royalties. That's it. That was his whole speech.
Right.
And I didn't even take notes after the fifth or the seventh time I heard it because
it was the same thing.
It was the same thing. We're not touching royalties. Well, you know, so we're in a conundrum. If we do touch royalties, you know, we could lose the activity we have. That's the biggest threat. But we're also, for a lot of these resources, now, I mean, I don't know what Tony Soprano and I mean, you're a cop. You know, you tell me what a mafia takes for their cut.
It's more than 3%.
My understanding is, you know, 3%, if you go,
according to Tulsa King.
Well, I haven't caught up on Tulsa King, but I mean, whatever it is, you know, if the old mafia thing was, if you can get 3% off of someone there, you know, they can hide it in their books and it's not hard to do. Well, if that's what all of our royalty structure is, which is, you know, shaping up that way, got to ask ourselves, are we getting a return?
There's a few texts. Alan in Kamsack, for example, says, I think it is time to raise royalties. And of course, a lot of people pointing out, you know, fair enough, there may be some disgruntled people in the industry, but where are they? I mean, this is still where the things are that they're mining. So it's not like they can pick up and sell shoes in another place. They still have to be here to mine.
And I mean, Eric Klein made that case very much in his book 2 years ago. You've had Aaron Weir on here talking about that. Yeah. I mean, and there are definitely arguments to be made by that.
Okay. I don't want to get too mired down in that. We've got lots of other things to talk about. We'll take our last break and we'll come back to finish up with Brian Zinchuk. I'll try and get to as many of your texts as I can. There's still some questions here, including, is Brian ever going to run for politics? Look forward to your answer on that when we come back here on 650 CKOM, 980 CJME. Yeah, yeah, welcome back to the show. We are wrapping up our conversation with Brian Zinchuk, editor, owner of PipelineOnline.ca. There is a question from Matt in Southeast Saskatchewan. He calls himself a Zinchuk fan, wants to know, are you going to run for politics?
My wife promised me many years ago that if I ever ran for politics, she'd divorce me because,
and you're happily married. So you don't want that.
Yeah. She still kind of likes me for some reason. I don't know why. And,
there's your answer, Matt. Terry from Buffalo Pound with a question. Is Brian aware of the rig drilling a mile east of K+S? Is it mining related?
Yes. Actually, that rig, and there's a couple out near, near Mosaic and, S-raising.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So those don't show up on rig counts. The ones at K+S, that the mine actually owns that rig.
Okay.
So the data that I report from is from the Canadian Association of Energy Contractors. And as far as I'm aware, that rig is not a member of it. So because they're not a member, they don't show up. The ones sometimes show up on the numbers for the S-raising ones, but generally speaking, they're not showing up in the same data.
Okay. We had a text this morning from a friend of ours on this program, Todd, from Big Sky, Montana. He's an expat. He was from Saskatchewan originally. He's down in Montana now. And he tells me something's going on with a pipeline. People are knocking on farmers' doors. People have actually received some money for a 30-inch pipeline that he thinks is coming from Canada down into Montana, North Dakota, and then maybe south.
This is the very first I've heard of it. There could be something in the works, but what's most likely is it's probably refurbishment or replacement of the Express pipeline, which is one of the export pipelines out of Alberta. It does not pass, one of a few that does not pass through Saskatchewan, and it goes straight south of Alberta through Montana. So that's the most likely thing, because if it was an international pipeline, there would have to be a presidential permit application to the U.S.
Oh, you'd think we'd hear about it.
And there would have to be a Canadian Energy Regulator process, and it would be enormous. There'd be the C-69 and everything else. Right. So the probability of it being an international pipeline, it's most likely just a repair job or refurbishment.
Okay. We, just a few minutes left here. You know, we've been following, of course, the notion of Canada becoming an energy superpower. And I see Nova Scotia is talking more and more about getting back into the natural gas game.
Yeah. So they actually built an offshore platform in the late 90s, and they were self-sufficient, and they were exporting gas into New England. My best friend actually worked on that pipeline. And then they ran out of gas on the Sable Island, and they, for some reason, about 12 years ago, you know, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick banned fracking. Well, you're not going to get onshore gas for fracking in that area, but it turns out they have quite a bit of gas. And they have a new premier in recent years who wants to build a whole mountain of wind generation, but he also, in recent times, has eliminated that ban on fracking and says they want to not only be self-sufficient, but export natural gas. Mm-hmm. Now, the equalization payments for this year, Nova Scotia got $3.5 billion. That is an enormous chunk of their budget. I'm not sure how much, but my guess would be probably a fifth, maybe more than that, maybe a third. So if they do produce fossil fuels, then that comes off the equalization thing for the money they get from that, which would reduce our burden in supporting them.
Mm-hmm.
So everything they do along that lines is a great idea.